Michael Knowles hosts the Michael Knowles Show on the Daily Wire. Make sure you check it out. It's funny, witty, informative, and believe it or not, in our political climate, it's actually positive. He's also an actor, author, conservative, political commentator, and columnist. He wrote what is probably the most in-depth and well-researched book I've ever read in my life, and I would even count my own in there. Reasons to Vote Democrat, a comprehensive guide. It is my pleasure to welcome Michael Knowles to Josh Peck Disclosure. Michael, how you doing?
Josh, I'm doing very well, and I can tell that you're a real scholar for having read my book. I'm really pleased to hear that.
Well, I'll tell you what, it's only 266 pages, but it's a very deep 266 mm-hmm. pages. It took me 8 years to complete, so 6 years longer than the book has even been out.
That's right. Well, it took me well over 20 years to research it, but I hope that all of that information is digestible, edifying for people who want to find out all of the reasons to vote for Democrats.
Yes, I agree. People should definitely check that out, and people should also read the Amazon reviews if they don't believe us on how amazing of a book it is.
Oh, yes, there are 3,000 very insightful conservatives have given their thoughts on the most important political magnum opus of our generation.
I love it. And who said conservatives don't have a sense of humor?
That's right.
So I want to start out, people in our culture, even many of those on the conservative side, you know, speaking of having a sense of humor and stuff, it seems a lot of people generally kind of overall seem to have an overall dismal outlook on our current time. Yet on your show, you always project a really positive outlook, which my wife and I and even our kids thoroughly enjoy. Well, why are you so optimistic? And why don't you just fall in line with everyone else and allow depression and anxiety to consume you until you're nothing but a dry, withered husk of your former youthful self?
That's right. It's like the line, my priest told me the line about the Scottish optimist and the Scottish pessimist. You know, the Scottish pessimist says things couldn't get any worse, and the Scottish optimist says, oh, yes, they can. That is what it seems like among conservatives sometimes. But there are a few reasons. One, Winston Churchill observed, for myself, I'm an optimist. It doesn't make a lot of sense to be anything else. That's part of it. But I don't think it's just a sort of shallow or blind optimism. When you look around for the first time in a long time, things are going well. They're not just going a little well, they're going very well. As a matter of politics, you know, the economy is booming, joblessness is at an all-time low, employment is at an all-time high. You've got trade deals that are being reworked that hasn't caused a trade war, that hasn't caused global recession. Things actually seem to be doing a bit better. The IMF credits the Trump administration for the boost in the global economy. On foreign affairs, we have relative peace abroad. We have potentially denuclearizing of North Korea, potentially denuclearizing of Iran. That would be quite good. On matters of sort of international silliness, you know, President Trump left the Paris Accord and we were told the sky would fall. Last time I checked, the sky is doing just fine. And on the cultural level, what's so important, because look, as a matter of domestic politics, the government is being deregulated. That's a very good thing. All of a sudden, the left is discovering the wonders of local government. They're saying, oh, perhaps we shouldn't give all of this power to the federal government. That's very good. And on a cultural level, for the first time in my life and in the lifetime of most millennials I know, the conservatives are the ones having fun. The conservatives are the ones who have an exuberance. We cite the blank book, but what the blank book is indicative of are all of those commenters and all of those reviewers who are having a little bit of fun finally. They're willing to shake out of their doer sensibilities, and they're saying, oh, things are quite nice. They can breathe. All of the late night comedians are crying on television. There is a comedy special, so-called comedy special, on Netflix called Nanette. It's this anti-comedy comedy. It's just a woman complaining for an hour about how difficult her life is. That's a ha ha ha, not a lot of comedy. Meanwhile, on the right, you know, people are having a good time because there's a little light. You know, it was Horace Walpole, I think, the English writer, who said that life is a comedy to the man who thinks and a tragedy to the man who feels. This seems to tie in nicely to Ben Shapiro's line about how facts don't care about your feelings. When you're in this tyranny of subjectivism, this tyranny of emotions, like you're seeing on the left, everything is so sad and upsetting and terrible. But when you just think, you look around, you have a little historical perspective, and you can see into the near future just a little bit, perhaps, things are going relatively very, very well for us. I see no reason to frown.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's a time like no other that I can remember in my lifetime, which isn't very long. I'm only 34. But still, I mean, it's kind of nice to be able to be happy and excited about politics. Whereas for me personally, before Trump, I really didn't have much of an interest in politics, but, Trump kind of cured that for me. And now I'm all in.
That's right. And, you know, one other aspect of Trump, because he jokes around, even just that, it breaks some of that tyranny of self-seriousness where they say, oh, you can't say that. You should. Oh, no, you're really this. Or then you're so nervous to say any word. I talked to my friends on the left. I had a lefty comedian come in, and he's coming out of this a little bit, but he would preface everything that he said with 17 apologies. I'd say, you don't have to apologize. This is a safe space. There's free air here. The other thing that President Trump has done that's pretty nice is that he has broken this ideological rigidity that I think had settled in even on the right. It had always settled in on the left, but on the right, we had gotten to be a little bit of a checklist sort of people. And ideology is always wrong. Mm. Ideology is the sort of thing you write down on a piece of paper and you say, the entire world, the whole universe, my experience of reality is on this piece of paper and everything else isn't true. And when people get ideological, they lose their sense of the world. When things don't comport with their ideological predictions, they go a little crazy. But I think one nice aspect of the Trump era is, hey guys, stop worrying about if something works in theory, if it works in practice. There is a practical knowledge to life that really matters. And I think we're seeing the fruits of that.
Yeah, it reminds me of what you said today on your show. It was either today or yesterday. I believe it was today, about how Trump's really genuine because he doesn't fit into any one of these ideologies. He's kind of a little bit of everything, but that makes him genuine. And he doesn't speak precisely. He's not exact about his language, but that also adds a lot of genuineness to him. And speaking of language, you recently did a PragerU video on the importance of language. Do you see a difference of approach to language between the political right and left? And if so, why do you think those differences arise?
Well, that is certainly the case. The left uses a lot of jargon and language that people in reality don't recognize. You hear them all the time. You hear these little tells when Cory Booker speaks or somebody. they talk about the folks, and they talk about being an ally, and they talk about intersectionality and social justice. And they don't say illegal alien. They say undocumented future American dreaming superstar. Well, I don't know, whatever language they use. And it's increasingly disconnected from reality. And this gets to ideology as well, which is that ideology in so many ways is just like a bag of vocabulary. You know the ideology by the words that people use. When you hear Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the socialist star of the Democrats, when you hear her talking about late-stage capitalism and class conflict, you know that she's coming to politics from a Marxist ideological perspective. You don't hear that on the right. Now, for a long time, I think the right has allowed ourselves to get trapped in the left's language. But once you use their language, you give up the whole game. And another great aspect of the Trump era, I remember this well from the 2016 campaign. He was using the word anchor babies, you know, when someone comes to America just to have a kid and then the kid gets birthright citizenship. And some journalists, by journalist, I mean Democrat operative masquerading as a journalist.
Right.
Some journalist said, don't you know, Mr. Trump, that the word anchor baby is very offensive? And Trump said, well, how's it offensive? What word should I use? And the guy said, you know, you've got to use the phrase undocumented future or dreaming, whatever. And Trump stares at him while he gets out this 20-second phrase. And then Trump looks at him, he says, I think I'm going to stick with anchor baby. I think that's going to work just fine. That freedom to say, no, we're not going to use your ridiculous manipulative language. We're going to speak freely. I mean, I think it really came to a head with the gender pronoun battles.
Yeah.
Because the left is, there's now so divorced from reality. They are forcing us. In certain countries, at the foot of a gun, they're saying, you need to call men women.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to call women men. And if you don't do it, we're going to punish you for that. And I think that was a bridge too far. I think some people just said, no, don't tell me to disbelieve my lying eyes. I can see in front of me that person is a man. And that very basic thing, I think, has led to a lot of great advancement in political language. We're finally free of some of those shackles.
Yeah, I agree, and it shows a lot of the hypocrisy too. Because if they're so strong and empowered and everything, like they shout at the rest of us, why is something as simple as a pronoun enough to crumble their entire existence? Literally, as they say it, you know, you're stealing my existence, my humanity away. And that's not what it is at all, of course.
It's funny that you bring up that example because they use this phrase. You might not hear it if you're in the mainstream of the culture, but you hear it on the fringes, San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles, on all of the college campuses. The phrase that they will use on the left to refer to conservatives, they'll say, for instance, if you disagree with a conservative, what have you done? You've just disagreed with them. You've said, okay, I don't agree with your opinion. And the conservative says, okay, well, too bad.
Yeah.
if you disagree with a lefty, the phrase that you increasingly hear is, you're erasing me.
Yeah.
This is erasure. You're erasing my lived identity. Because for them, the essence of not only political identity, but personal identity, because to the left, the personal is the political. The essence is this ideology. When you disagree with that opinion, you have rejected them personally. And that's a ridiculous point of view, and we should obviously laugh at it. I think it would be better, certainly for society, but it would be better for them. They'd be less angry and maddened all the time.
Yeah, and maybe they'd actually be able to grow and learn some new things, as we all should be doing. Now, I think this might be contributing to the destruction of the leftist culture. I mean, right now the lefties kind of own the culture. But do you think that conservatives are going to win the culture back? And if so, what would that look like?
Well, I don't know. In the long run, we're all dead, to quote John Maynard Keynes. And when you look broadly at the modern era from, say, the Protestant Revolution to the present, I don't know that on the long run we're going to recover the culture into any serious moral or political sense. Mm-hmm. But there can be good blips. There can be good little bits of recovery. And we're seeing that now. We are seeing at least the pendulum swing back a little. You see it with Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Right.
Christmas, the Christmas is the holiday that must not be named. And the left always denies this. They say, there's no war on Christmas. You crazy conservatives think there's a war on Christmas. And you say, okay, well, if there's no war on Christmas, then just say Merry Christmas. They say, no, we have to say Happy Holidays. So, well, what are the other holidays that are going on? They say, well, what about Hanukkah? You say, well, Hanukkah was a month ago. So, okay, well, what about Kwanzaa? Nobody celebrates Kwanzaa. Well, what about the winter solstice? Do you celebrate the winter solstice? No, it's because they don't want to use that phrase because the left is essentially opposed to the very civilization that created it, Western civilization. And that's what it is. When you have a culture that kind of breaks free of those shackles, then as you've been seeing for the last year or so, people are more willing to say Merry Christmas. They're more willing to use the word illegal alien rather than these silly euphemisms. They're willing to use precise language. And one way that conservatives can win back the culture is by using precise language. Don't give them these little inches, because when you lose language, you lose entire premises. This was the question of gay marriage. This is where this came up most clearly. Some conservatives say, oh, it's fine, who cares? We can redefine marriage, it doesn't matter. And that's a fair argument for them to have, I suppose. But what the left did is they changed, using language, they changed that debate. The debate was whether we should redefine marriage to include monogamous same-sex unions. For some reason, not polygamous same-sex unions, but just specifically monogamous same-sex unions. Should we redefine marriage that way? Does sexual difference have something to do with marriage? Do men and women have something to do with marriage? And they subverted that entirely by saying, do you have the right? Do gay people have the right to marriage? Presupposing that marriage already included monogamous same-sex unions.
Right.
And once it's a question of rights, yeah, of course, everybody should have equal rights. But that was never the debate. They just tricked us with language.
Yeah, we see that a lot too. But I think in the Trump era, more people on the right, instead of feeling bad about it or feeling guilty or feeling like they've done something wrong or offended somebody, I think conservatives more now, especially younger millennial ones like you and I, are starting to kind of wake up and realize, you know what, that really doesn't matter, because this is the truth, and whatever you want to, you know, whatever fantasy you want to play in is just not going to hold water there. I don't even know if this is possible at this point, to have a functioning culture where both the left and the right could somehow coexist and have productive conversations and things like that. I mean, obviously we're coexisting now. We're not at least not yet, blowing each other up or anything like that. But what would the left have to do to maintain their hold on the culture in a way that the right could go along with to at least in some sense?
Well, we are certainly coexisting. There's no civil war yet.
Right.
And this is probably smart of the left because the right has all the guns. So it would probably not behoove them to start a civil war anytime soon. But the real breakdown is this breakdown of language. If you want to be able to communicate, then you have to agree on objective definitions of words. If we don't have objective definitions of words, then you're just a bunch of screaming animals, aren't you? You're just grunting. And politics ceases to be a discourse and a debate over different areas and over different generations, and it becomes a brute force battle of individual interests that can never coincide. This is what the left is descending into. There was a video of Charlie Kirk and Candace Owens from TPUSA. They were at some event, and there were protesters just shrieking in their face, not really shrieking words, just shrieking sounds.
Yeah.
And that's a great metaphor for what has happened broadly in the culture. We're not using the same language. We're not agreeing on terms. The left is the aggressor in that. It's because of a radical subjectivism. It's because they're saying, oh, no, words don't have meaning. It's just whatever we say things are, that's how we're going to get along in society. If we're going to use certain language and depict reality in a certain way, and then poof, magically, it's going to become that way. That isn't going to happen. There's certainly not going to be any way for the left and the right to coexist if we're just forcing one another to believe each other's ridiculous fantasy of reality. What we have to do, rather, is agree on aspects of reality. And right now, the conservative, and I think for a very long time, conservatives have a better hold on that. And the left is truly out there in la-la land. It's up to them. We, you know, it would be very nice to say, oh, you guys come this far and we'll come this far. But you can't meet in the middle when it's a question of reality and fantasy. You really have to have the left come debate in good faith, on honest terms, about whether we want socialist health care or whether we want to redefine marriage or whether we want to raise taxes or whatever. If you're not debating those things in good faith, then we can't meet in the middle.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And the language is so important. That event that you messaged or that you referenced, one of the things that they were screaming was F white supremacy. But they, white women mostly, but what white people were screaming that at a black woman.
That's right.
I mean, talk
that's
about
what
hypocrisy.
Saying.
I mean, it's projecting.
Yes, they are. They are always projecting.
Yeah.
It's all of these white women. When they weren't just shrieking sounds, they said F white supremacy, and they were yelling at Candace Owens, a black woman. And the irony here is that they are the ones projecting a white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones saying, you black woman have to think and behave and talk exactly like we tell you to. And if not, we're going to get in your face and we're going to physically intimidate you. They're always doing that. But, you know, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. You need a little bit of humility and a little bit of awe and reverence to have wisdom. And the left has rejected all of that. The left hosts pride marches, not just gay pride, not just LGBT LMNOP pride, pride for every aspect of their coalition. And, pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. If you've got one side that is utterly without humility, then you're never going to be able to communicate, for one, and you're never going to be even self-aware to begin that conversation.
Amen. And you know what another piece of hypocrisy that kind of came out today was they'll take part in these protests, and I think protesting is fine, you know, in principle, but they'll enjoy their right to free speech and stuff, but then they don't value that same right. Like, for example, you know, regardless of what the audience thinks about the guy, Alex Jones got banned from basically the internet today. And
that's right.
I just total censorship. And, you know, listen, I don't agree with everything that he says, but I still think he should have the right to say it. But at the same time, YouTube is a corporation. They can do what they want. But it kind of shows that they don't maintain the same American values that they also enjoy. And
Of course.
Yeah. This led me to a question, because I've experienced this a lot. I actually used to get a couple hundred thousand views on every video I did. Now I'm lucky if I get a few hundred. Sorry to tell you that now, after you have agreed to the interview. But I'm
sorry, sure. we'll try to tweet it out, and they censor me every now and again, but maybe we'll be able to get through big tech's big censorship.
Yeah, that'd be great. Anything you can do. But I was wondering, I've noticed it here and at Skywatch TV, have you guys at the Daily Wire experienced censorship on social media like YouTube? And if so, have you had any success in fighting against it?
Absolutely, we have. My show is regularly censored on Facebook and YouTube, and it's ebbed and flowed. At certain times, they'll knock every show that I do. Sometimes they give us a little breathing room. I think it depends on the whims of these executives when they wake up in the morning in Silicon Valley. Luckily now, we're at least being able to reach more of an audience than a couple months ago. They were really dinging us. And it's that capriciousness, it's that arbitrariness that has conservatives worried. You mentioned Alex Jones. I mean, Alex Jones is a conspiratorial, frequently incoherent vitamin salesman who takes his shirt off on camera. But we should defend him. We should defend him from censorship. It's very funny that Apple, Google, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all of these guys decided that the best way they were going to prove a conspiracy theorist wrong was at the same time banning him. I'm ready to break out my tinfoil hat. And the reason is, do I think that Alex Jones has a strong grasp on public policy? No. Although I do sometimes listen to him late at night on the radio because he can be an entertaining broadcaster. Sure. But no, I don't think he's a conservative. I don't think he's part of the conservative movement. But the conservatives should defend him, because for the left right now, while we might be able to see the distinction between the various commentators and writers and thinkers on the right, to the left, there is no difference between Alex Jones and William F. Buckley Jr. Yeah. What they are doing is they're censoring Jones because it's easy, because he's a little kooky, and they're censoring him as a way of establishing the principle to further censor the rest of us. We've all been censored to one degree or another already, and it seems to me, by today's actions, that it's only going to get worse.
Yeah, and that's something that I appreciate about your show, too, is because you'll welcome liberals on who are willing to talk to you. And I just got to say, on a personal note, the Tom Arnold interview, that not only made my day, that probably made my year.
You know, when Tom came in, we had to redo the set because it was like a Tasmanian devil coming through. But I got to tell you, I've got to give Tom Arnold a lot of credit.
Sure.
The interview was pretty wild. wasn't the most staid interview ever. But I got to give him credit. I invite Democrats and non-conservatives on all the time. Two people have said yes. Tom Arnold and a comedian by the name of Jamie Kilstein. Those are the only two that say yes. I invite Democrats on all the time. They won't come on because they don't want to have an exchange of ideas. They don't want to debate or discuss anything. They just want to hurl vicious slander. They call every conservative a racist and a bigot and this, totally baselessly. And then they want to censor us. When it's not enough to slander us, they censor us.
And I think that what you're doing and what I'm trying to do and what many other conservatives out there are doing, I think that is eventually what is going to win over some of the more not as far left liberals out there, because we hear a lot of former liberals say, you know, I didn't leave liberalism or leftism or whatever, liberalism left me. So if the left continues pushing farther and farther left, do you think that it will end in the collapse of society as a whole, or do you think that just more and more people will eventually become conservative?
Well, there are two sides to this. In the short run, this is a wonderful thing for the country and for conservatives, because you saw at that Netroots conference over the weekend, the Democrat Party is running hard left. Mm-hmm. They are embracing socialists after a century trying to distance themselves from socialists. They're saying abolish law enforcement. They're saying no borders, amnesty for all illegal aliens. And we see the public polling. Those issues are all losers among the American people. They are ghettoizing themselves electorally, and they're going to lose votes in the short run. And we're also seeing this even just when you look at various electoral coalitions. Just this week, a big headline is that President Trump's support among black voters has nearly doubled in just a few months. It went from 15% to 29%. These are all good things. The trouble, of course, is in the long run, because in the long run, we're seeing the oldest continually existent political party in the world, the Democrat Party, is now embracing really dangerous ideas and really fringe ideas and really awful ideas like socialism.
Yes.
And in the long run, that's going to have a corrosive effect on society, because these ideas might not win in 2018 or 2020, but at some point there will be a crisis, the left will grab onto it, and the consequences won't be very good. It's why conservatives have to both celebrate their craziness now, but also pretty vigorously refute these awful ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and they're really getting them young, too. I mean, due to the vast amount of indoctrination from our education system, do you think, I mean, especially in the universities, do you think that many millennials today actually probably are more conservative than they think, but just don't realize it yet because they hear, you know, conservative and they think Nazi and racist, yet a lot of them want to go out and like start a small business or something?
That's true. I must take a little Shapiro-esque pessimism here, though, because I don't think millennials think very much at all. Millennials are perhaps the worst educated generation in history,
yes,
but they're the most credentialed. So they think that they're very educated. But socialists since Lenin and Stalin have relied on useful idiots to push their pernicious ideology. Mm. We now know, just a lot of public polling shows, that the majority of American millennials would fail a basic civics test. On a national survey, only 40% of people could name, 40% of respondents couldn't name a single aspect of the First Amendment. Only 1 in 1,000 could name every aspect, all of the rights, religion, speech, freedom of the press, right, all of those rights. Very few people know that. Something like 90% of American millennials cannot explain what checks and balances is. They cannot explain our federal system. A huge majority of them can't explain the purpose of the Bill of Rights. And this is because their education has been empty. They haven't learned foundational aspects of civics or history or literature. They've learned ideology. Instead of the history textbook, they're reading A People's History of the United States, that polemic propaganda by Howard Zinn. They're learning ideological disciplines, women's studies instead of history, say, ethnicity studies. The way we pillory it is a lesbian dance theory or something,
right.
You know. They're learning all of this nonsense, so they don't have a depth of education. And if you don't know anything, if you don't stand for anything, then you'll fall for anything. I think that's what we're seeing now. Millennials were born after the fall of the Berlin Wall. They don't even have a visceral knowledge of communism. They didn't see it with their own eyes, and that does not bode well for us.
And it seems to me, generally speaking, that conservatives are more likely to self-educate. And because of that, you know, conservatives typically argue with logic and leftists argue with emotion. If leftists won't listen to logic, what do you find is the best way to get through to a leftist? Or is it just a pointless endeavor to even try?
Humor is the way. Humor is the way to do it, because you're right. Conservatives broadly self-educate because they have to.
Yes.
There's no
yeah.
alternative. How else do you read conservative works? And even by conservative works, I even mean the great books. I mean foundational texts in addition to conservative political philosophy. You're not going to get it in your K-12 education. You're not going to get it on university campuses broadly. So you have to self-educate. If the left is unwilling to do that, if they're in these bubbles and cocoons in their safe spaces where they never have to encounter their own prejudices, then the way that you can convince them and convince others is to mock their stupid ideas. Humor is a powerful, powerful tool. And joy goes a long way in politics, and it's very persuasive. Nikki Haley, our wonderful ambassador to the UN,
yes,
made a slight error, I felt, a couple weeks ago, which is that she denigrated the phrase owning the libs, you know,
right,
using humor to sort of mock the left. I think owning the libs is the great way forward. If they're not going to be able to engage logically, you can make them laugh and you can make people watching them laugh because it will tickle something that is deeper, a sort of practical knowledge will be tickled by that. And I think it will show the absurdity of leftist doctrine and dogma. You know, the dogma lives loudly within them. And so we've got to shake them free of it, I think. And one way to do that is with a laugh.
Well, I can even speak to that to my own personal experience. I mentioned earlier that before Trump announced that he was going to run for president, I didn't really have much of an interest in politics, and I didn't really know what right versus left meant, or didn't really know any of it. But I got interested because Donald Trump is hilarious. You know, whether you love him or hate him, he's absolutely hilarious. I have a quote going around Skywatch that Derek Gilbert, the host of Skywatch TV, quoted me as saying, if Donald Trump wins, the world might end, but at least it'll be hilarious.
that's exactly right. That is exactly right. What a way to go out. You know, at least you're going out in a sort of free way and in a free culture. No, that humor is so important. And Trump is a master of it. But there's an exuberance on the right that you see anyway.
Yeah.
We were talking about the blank book earlier. The blank book is an old joke. It actually in America, it goes back all the way to the 1880 presidential election. The Republican ticket of James Garfield and Chester Arthur part of their campaign material was they published a blank book called The Political Achievements and Statesmanship of My Opponent, General Hancock, the Democrat nominee for president. That is, so clearly there's good provenance for this joke in the GOP side, but that is owning the libs, and that's using humor to do it. And we've let our humor fall into disuse over the past 20 years. We've been a little too earnest, I think. And that gets tedious. Self-seriousness gets tedious. And the Chesterton quote is that angels can fly because they can take themselves lightly. That's very attractive.
Yes, definitely. To kind of wrap it up here, I know you're busy and I don't want to keep you too long, but we've heard a lot about, you know, how to win the culture back, but how, being that language is so incredibly important, how can conservatives win the language back?
The way to win the language back is to be diligent. You have to have immense attention to detail. And this creates a little awkwardness sometimes. When somebody says to you, they're referring to a man who thinks he's a woman as a she, you have to say he.
Right.
I know this seems rude. We conservatives don't, we just want to be sort of amiable to everybody, and nobody wants to be rude to somebody in person. But when we're speaking about the culture, when we're speaking about broad things, you have to be precise in your language, because the only tool of the left is emotional manipulation. And their key tool to do that is language. In fact, they emotionally manipulate you to use their language. We should reject that utterly. And you know, it might take a little practice, because the indoctrination goes pretty deep. But you've really got to reach down and be precise in your language, because language is the stuff of our consciousness. Language is politics. It's how we communicate. Speech is that aspect. And so when you use precise language, you'll notice that the conversation shifts, not just personally, but culturally. We're already seeing that happen. And I think that is our best tool moving forward.
And like most things, it is worth the hard work that it takes to put in it. It is well worth it. To close up here, what do you want most for people to take away from this interview, your work, and your show?
Well, I hope that the book has convinced them of certain electoral aspects that they should pay attention to. But from that precision of language, I think that's very important, because one problem we were just talking about, how people don't know a lot about history, is if you just read a book written before you were born or before a century ago or two centuries ago, you'll see that people... different language creates different visions of the world. If you speak multiple languages, or if you read in different languages or whatever, even in different time frames, you'll say, oh, this culture at this time saw things a little differently. And then at this time, people saw things a little differently. And it really cools everything down, because we have such a bias, such a prejudice for the present. We're always on Twitter. We're always scrolling for whatever's new. The news cycle these days lasts about 45 seconds. And it's maddening, and it gets you very anxious. But if you get a little perspective, a little historical perspective, a little linguistic perspective, it will calm you down. Your life will be better. You can smile and embrace all of the covfefe. Speaking of creative uses of language, it will calm down the politics. It will make it much less rambunctious and angry and urgent.
That's right. Where can people go online to find more about you or catch your show?
Got to check out the show at dailywire.com. You can see it there, or on YouTube and Facebook when we're not being censored. And you can always find me on Twitter at Michael J. Knowles.
Yes, and everybody, make sure you do go to the Daily Wire. Make sure you sign up for the show. Subscribe, because he's got to make that money, honey.
Got to make that money, honey. And you'll get a leftist tears tumbler when you subscribe. And that's very important these days, because those tears are bountiful. They are flowing from the sky.
Oh, yeah. And ever since the Tom Arnold interview, you are well stocked. You got to get rid of some of your supply.
No, I'm drowning in here.
Well, this has been an absolute blast. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We're definitely going to have you back on again soon.
Josh, thanks for having me.
All right. You can help fight against censorship by making a one-time donation or setting up a monthly donation to Josh Peck Disclosure at joshpeckdisclosure.com/donate. Or, for as little as $1 a month, you can become a Peck patron by heading over to patreon.com/joshpeck. As a Peck patron, you will be entered into contests to have your content featured on the Josh Peck Disclosure homepage, contribute chapters to a collaborative book with Josh Peck, and win a special Josh Peck collection full of materials worth hundreds of dollars. Also, for as little as $3 a month, you will have access to free downloads of Josh Peck books, such as Quantum Creation, Cherubim Chariots, and more. Josh Peck Disclosure is viewer-funded. Head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com for more information. Right now, head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com, the central hub for everything Josh Peck Disclosure. Every day, you'll get brand new videos, podcasts, updates, and more. Make sure you subscribe at youtube.com/joshpeckdisclosure. Also, make sure you click the bell and select the option to always be notified when a new video is released. Follow Josh Peck Disclosure on Twitter at JPDisclosure and get involved with the show on our official Facebook page at facebook.com/joshpeckdisclosure. Disclosure. If you're on Steemit and prefer DTube, follow Josh Peck at steemit.com/@Josh Peck and make sure to upvote all Josh Peck Disclosure DTube videos. Keep checking back at joshpeckdisclosure.com for news, information, updates, and more.